like for council members. Part of our salary and part of using this chamber is paid by MUS. And I contend that that's not right. I contend that the portion like for our salaries and for the use of council chambers should be bored by city, not by MUS. Initially, the PUB set a policy that each utility should stand on its own feet. Each utility should make its own money, pay its own bills. I agree with that. But when you take $4 million from the utilities and you don't pass on the rate increases, it's hard for the utilities to stand on their own feet. And sooner or later, we're going to have a problem over there like we've got over on the city side. And I want to avoid that problem if I can.
And this board today made it real clear the answer is still no.
3, 2, 1. The school board asked the public several questions about the graduation requirement changes. Things like, should biology and algebra be required? Should elective courses be reduced from 8 credits now to 6 credits? Should 22 instead of 21 credits be required before graduation? And what about an exit exam? One of the proposals asks if students should have to take a competency test demonstrating that they have mastered basic skills before graduating. But of all the proposals, the one that generated the most comment was changing the physical education requirement. Now students have to take 2 years of PE. The proposed change would let students who participate in 2 different team sports for 2 years take only 1 year of PE. Nearly a third of the people who spoke don't think that being on the football or basketball team is a good substitute for a physical education course. Valerie Bjornstad was one of several who opposed that change.
Are we allowing special privileges to athletes because they're talented? And if we are we allowing those same privileges to others who are talented in other areas such as math and science? Are we dropping math credits for them participating in an activity related to math?
One student, David Riggins at West Valley High School, supported the PE change and says a lot of students do too.
We just recently conducted a survey of about 439 students, and I did not bring the figures. They're still in the rough stage. They will be eventually submitted, but I can tell you right now, of the 439 submitted, 40% were in favor of this waiving of 1 credit. So that's from a student point of view.
The changes had more support. Parent John Swain thinks kids need the challenge.
I think we let our children down when we lower our standards or fail to raise our standards to a level where that it is challenging and it gives them the skills that they need to succeed today.
But others feel the proposals ask too much. Wendell Schiffler teaches at-risk freshmen and sophomores at Lathrop High School.
But I think that raising the requirements will cause a little bit of distress for many of the kids who are below average or at risk.
And Tracy Duncan is a concerned parent.
I'm the parent of what I guess you would call an at-risk student. And when I think of some of the increased requirements that I'm seeing, I think this could make the difference between whether he graduates or whether he's a school dropout.
Many of the parents and students don't see a need for changes. They say college-bound students will take the courses they need to take anyway, and the basic requirements now work for those who want to take a more vocational approach. West Valley High School student Janet Veach.
And I think that it would put more of a stress on the students that don't know if they can meet up to those and have like learning problems, and I think that would just create more stress for them. And I think that quality needs to be looked at before quantity does. I think the quality of our classes should be reassessed.
Parents and teachers also offered another suggestion. Perhaps different diplomas with different course emphasis could be offered for students in college prep, vocational, or general education courses. And some parents suggested that the board start looking at curriculum at the early years of school, not just the last 4. The board took testimony for nearly 2 hours last night. Hearings are also scheduled in November. Board members haven't decided yet exactly what changes, if any, they might make in graduation requirements. Any changes would take effect next fall for incoming freshmen. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Residents of the area where the development would take place and skiing enthusiasts filled the Borough Assembly chambers to offer their input on the plan. One section of the public that the developers did not have to try to win over were the ski lovers.
I don't think it's good that all my money is going to Alyeska. We spend a lot of money taking our family down there to get some real skiing in. I would just as soon stay here.
I think the whole idea is it's a local ski area. It's not a big ski area development. It's something for the community to enjoy. And the borough has certainly spent plenty of money on other recreational activities, and this is something the borough really isn't going to have to be putting much out in pocket, and I think it would be a real nice thing for the community.
My daughter and I are both downhill skiers, and we frequently ski at both Cleary Summit and at Fort Wainwright. These are pathetic replicas of ski slopes, if any of you have ever been outside and skied. We go outside to Colorado or Utah to ski at least 2 weeks a year, sometimes four, to satisfy our hunger for downhill skiing. I would certainly rather put the money in the Fairbanks economy and ski here far more frequently.
Roger Evans wants to develop a downhill skiing facility near Murphy Dome on Moose Mountain. The borough owns the 1,200 acres of undeveloped land that Evans wants to buy for the project. Assembly action is needed to allow an agreement to be worked out to sell that land. That approval would mean Evans could go ahead and recruit financial backers for the skiing facility. Some local residents didn't mind the idea of a ski resort. They were more upset about the residential project that's tied into it. Evans wants to build about 200 homes to make the project more feasible. And almost all of the area residents were concerned about the increased traffic, noise, and impact on the area's water supply for the snowmaking equipment.
The noise would greatly increase due to more densely spaced dwellings, more automobiles, more snow machines, more people, more dogs, more ATVs. You could just go on and on with the list.
All of a sudden, we're going from a quiet residential area, which everybody moved out there for. I just purchased this property 6 months ago, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting in the middle of a ski resort. I personally don't favor the idea.
I'm concerned that lights associated with the resort will essentially take away my chances of seeing the northern lights for my residents, which is really one of the highlights of living in Fairbanks in the winter.
I am very opposed to this alpine ski resort being established so close to me on Moose Mountain. The idea of having potentially 200 additional residential lots is not appealing to me at all.
The proposed project has many hidden costs to the borough in terms of road upgrades, increased air pollution, needs for law enforcement, needs for schools with an increased number of residents, and other hidden costs.
But for each of the opponents, there was an almost equal number who supported the project, and one who didn't think the neighbors' comments should stop it.
I hear a lot of opposition because the ski slope is in their backyard. And quite bluntly, I'm sick to death of that argument. Let's face it, because we own a small parcel of land, it doesn't give us the right to dictate or control the surrounding public lands.
At a town meeting and again last night, project manager Roger Evans said he will do as much as he can to keep area property owners happy. Evans wanted the assembly to give its approval so he could get started with a project he's been hoping to develop for some time.
It's become so difficult to acquire suitable land anymore that only a couple new ski areas are built each year in the United States. Even in Alaska, our land is shrinking at an alarming rate as it gets divvied up between competing factions. This may be our only chance to set aside a full-size ski area site in Fairbanks. Moose Mountain is the only good site we could find that isn't covered with mining claims or residential development, or is simply too far away.
Assembly members want guarantees that Evans will actually develop a ski resort with the land and not just build residential homes. They approved an agreement that would let the mayor work out further details to try to meet all of the concerns of the area residents. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ian Thornson.
This is not aimed at new assembly members. It's that I don't feel there's any control on the assembly being exercised as far as decorum. And I have no control over that. The only thing I have control over is my staff.
With our staffing level and our manning, there really is little flexibility in what we can do and what decisions the council can make without adding additional appropriations, additional funds to fund additional positions for downtown or anywhere else in the community.
3, 2, 1. Just 2 weeks ago, Fairbanks voters approved a tax cap. It sets up a formula that the city must follow to determine just how much revenue it can raise through property taxes. But there might be some question as to what the starting figure in that equation should be. The tax cap, which one city council member insists should actually be called a revenue cap, is devised through a relatively simple formula. Take the amount of money levied through taxes the year before. Subtract from that number what the city paid in principal and interest on old debts. After that is done, you add in money for inflation. Then you have to add in expenses that can be excluded, things like new construction, interest on loans that will be paid during the year, and judgments against the city. The final sum is the maximum amount of money the city can bring in through property taxes that year. The mill rate can then be set to raise that amount. So the final amount, or the budget figure you have to work within as far as raising property taxes goes, all depends on the first number you use, the amount of actual taxes levied. Now, voters also approved an initiative that rolls back the mill rate to 2.8, but not quite. The question asked whether the year 1988, when the mill levy was 2.8, should be used as a base year to compute the tax cap. That year, $2.7 million was levied in taxes. But if the tax cap had been in place, estimates are that more revenue actually could have been collected under the cap. So the question is, can you compute the cap for 1990 using the $2.7 million figure as a starting point, or can you use the larger amount that could have been raised if the cap were in place that year? That would mean a better revenue picture for 1990. City Attorney Herb Cuss is leaning towards that interpretation.
So what we're really doing is saying, what would the council have done had the tax cap been in effect in 88 and in 89 in order to determine what 1990 is? You can make that interpretation of it very easily. It's a matter of applying the concept of base year. If you apply a base year in terms of the actual numbers that we experienced in terms of the amount of tax revenues realized and carry those forward into 89 and only reconstruct 89, then that's a more constrictive interpretation.
The city council spent 2 hours talking about the budget revenue estimate Saturday morning. The problem is council members had the wrong numbers to look at. The draft proposal they were given projected a deficit of less than $1 million, using $17 million as a revenue figure based on a mill rate of 7.3. That certainly was not acceptable to some city council members, since it was actually an increase in the mill levy once again. But after further discussion, it was determined that they used the wrong figure to begin with. So the picture will change. And while the mill rate and revenue projection could get lower, the deficit could get higher. City Manager Brian Phillips is working with the higher revenue projection right now. That would give the city a $16 million budget for next year, meaning nearly $2 million would have to be trimmed. The mill rate would be close to 6. If the city does not recalculate the 1988 budget year, it will have a smaller base figure to work with. Estimated revenues would only be $14 million, and the deficit closer to $4 million. That would mean a mill rate of 4, though, a figure that could be much more palatable to city council members. The city manager plans to get new budget figures to council members by the end of the week. He needs some direction at next Monday night's council meeting so that a balanced budget can be drafted for the council's review in November. And there are other budget matters the city council will have to look at, too. The municipal utility system currently pays 7% of its revenues to the city. Members of the council, who are also on the Public Utilities Board, would like for that percentage to be reevaluated and possibly lowered, so that MUS will have a little more money to work with as its budget is being developed too. And the council will also have to look at raising the rates for garbage collection in town. Since the city is paying more to dump at the landfill, it might consider a $2 a month increase in garbage collection fees. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Back in a quiet corner of the UAF campus, next to married student housing and where children play, three houses make up the Nana dorm. Freshman boys live in one house, girls another, and house parents Greg and Nellie Moore live in the third with their two elementary age children. The Nana Regional Corporation began paying for the Nana dorm program 6 years ago. The Moores have lived here for the past two. Nellie Moore is a Kotzebue native who attended college at UAF in the mid-70s. She knows how tough it can be for these students as she now helps them adjust to campus life.
Some of the problems range from bringing students in from rural areas who come from very small high schools and do not get an education adequate for entry-level courses at the university campus. We also face a problem of trying to help students deal with professors who would just as soon weed them out rather than deal with them. That's a big problem for us. And just, you know, trying to help them cope with living in a much larger community where, you know, things are a lot faster and different, and they don't have that, you know, core village atmosphere of having a large number of people who care a lot about them.
Not all of the students who apply to live in the Nana House get in. The advisors feel that the atmosphere might not work for some, like older students attending college for the first time. Moore says Nana students are expected to follow stricter rules than other students.
Well, they're expected to abide by a certain curfew. They're required to attend all of their classes. They meet with us on a weekly basis, each one of them. We go over their work. We talk about problems that they may be having. We work with pretty closely with their advisors at Rural Student Services. In some cases, we've worked with their professors. Just, it's a lot more intense, I think, for them than a regular college student who comes here with a lot of freedom.
They need a ride to Safeway or 7-Eleven. I charge them those 75 cents a trip.
75 cents.
Verne C.M. and Lance Kramer are two of the students living in the Nana houses this fall. They are part of a group that Nellie Moore is excited about.
From what I've seen, they're more independent than students we've had in the past, and I think are enjoying being here.
So far this year, both Lance and Vernay say things are going well. Both students are pretty typical freshmen, enjoying the less structured course schedule than you have in high school, and even trying to catch a soap opera when they can in the afternoon. A hunter and fisherman from Kotzebue, Lance is planning to get into wildlife management. He wants to go back to Kotzebue and work for the Department of Fish and Game when his studies are finished. And Kramer is very happy in the Nana dorm setup.
It's really comfortable in there, you know. It's not like a dorm at McIntosh or any place because, you know, it's either noisy there or people are partying all the time. But this is a nice, it's like living at home except you got five brothers.
Brene is one of the three girls in the Nana program this fall. She lived in Kiana for the last 2 years, coming to UAF after going to the Rural Alaska Honors Institute the past two summers. She says that program prepared her well for college life. She's a very active freshman and wanted to live in the Nana house so that she could become a little more disciplined.
I like the structure. The summer programs that I went to, Rawhide, were very structured and very intense. And I like the idea of having something that'll help me be responsible and help me get those skills down so I can have them later on.
The fact that Verne and Lance believe they are doing okay in school this fall should come as some relief to Nellie Moore. Moore feels the difference between attending small native high schools and others in the state can be too much for some students.
It's a real tragedy, I think, what we're doing to some of the students because they come here from high schools like that thinking, you know, that they've received a good education and probably have graduated with honors from their high schools, and they come here and they can't handle it. You know, the courses are too hard, or, you know, they can't make it into the 100-level courses, so they spend a couple of years in the, you know, the 050s and courses like that. They come here and they end up having a real identity crisis.
Moore says last year was a good one, though. The girls in the Nana dorm finished the spring semester with a C average. Right now, the Nana dorm is only for freshmen, but things could change. As students enter higher grade levels, they face even more demanding courses. And Moore says they still face a lot of difficulty and need the support the Nana dorm can bring. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. After serving as a delegate to Alaska's Constitutional Convention, the mayor of Nenana, and in the state Senate, Senator Jack Coghill says he's ready to take on the role of lieutenant governor. Coghill first ruled out a run for the state's top job.
As you know, there are already three fine candidates in the race for governor on the Republican side. For me to enter that race would be folly. However, I believe I have a role to play in the executive leadership of Alaska at this time as an agenda setter.
As the agenda setter, Coghill says the state needs to quit spending its wealth and reinvest in the future. He also believes Alaskans should learn from past mistakes, pull together, and work to expand the state's economy. And in the tradition of a Republican candidate, he believes the state's political leaders must work with the private sector so it can lead the way.
Unless we have leaders who understand the strong executive form of government written into our Constitution, who aren't afraid of making decisions and yet caring enough to get their input and support from the Alaskan people, our young people will be idle. Our old people will be forgotten, left out of a land of plenty with nothing to do. There are others outside of Alaska who have their own agenda for us. Some would like us to do nothing but merely serve their own purposes. They would cut off access to our resources, place legal handcuffs on our options, make resource development so costly that no business, however responsible, can survive. This we cannot and should not tolerate.
Coghill believes as lieutenant governor, he could work well with any of the three candidates that have announced intentions to run for governor.
I probably have philosophical differences with all three of them, but I'm going to be the agenda setter. And I plan on waging a very vigorous campaign, a campaign for the future of Alaska and for the development of its resources. One of the problems that we have is that in the past 10 years we've been spending our asset base or our wealth to operate government day to day. That would be like a hotel operator selling a bed out of his hotel room in order to pay the light bill. And that's what we're doing. We're not investing in the future. I plan on setting that agenda. The philosophical differences between the three of them will have to be decided by the electorate.
Coghill plans to get the word out about his agenda in the coming months as he raises campaign funds. The Nenana resident will establish his 1990 Lieutenant Governor campaign headquarters in Fairbanks. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornson.
Of course, we'll have ICE, so any type of ICE-related event we can do. We'll have any kind of trade show, concerts, rodeos, anything that a large 35,000-square-foot sheet of concrete can house, we can do. And so basically multi-purpose means multi-event, giving us a lot of flexibility in the type of activity that we can stage in the center. There's just absolutely no question that having an additional facility like the Carlson Center in Fairbanks is going to help both Anchorage and Fairbanks. In the past, we've only had one major venue in the state that could accommodate some of the major entertainment and professional sports activity we've tried to bring up. By having the Carlson Center in place, now we'll have better, more buying power. We'll have two venues, and that's going to give us more leverage to get to events up here. So, yes, it's going to help a lot.
Cooper told the conference the subsistence problem won't go away in part because of a decision at the time of statehood to treat all Alaskans exactly alike.
We made the decision coming into statehood that we were all in it together, and that each citizen under the law would be treated equally. So we had in some way to put that concept of rural subsistence in a way that was consistent with our other values that we adopted and have had ever since statehood.
When the Kenaitse went to court this summer to assert their subsistence rights, the decision on what constitutes a rural area fell into the hands of a federal judge in San Francisco, according to Cooper.
I know what rural is, they said. It means cows. Have you seen any cows in the villages lately?
Cooper says the courts have suggested they will consider communities with more than 2,500 people as urban, and places outside the city limits of places like Fairbanks as rural.
I would be able to get a subsistence permit, whereas a person living in Barrow or Bethel or Kotzebue would not be able to get a subsistence permit.
Cooper apologized for proposing a solution to the state's congressional delegation without consulting Native organizations. He said he didn't know how to deal with the Kanaitse subsistence hunting situation, but said to solve the problem, the state and Native organizations need to reach a consensus.
That we ought to go to the Congress with a solution that the state agrees on and the Native community agrees on. If we do that, then I don't think we're going to have any problem in getting our legislation.
Cooper said the solutions necessary to solve the dilemma are available in the expertise of the conference delegates themselves. I'm Jeff Kennedy.
We are getting approximately 12 to 14 calls an hour, and they're mostly of about mothers, brothers, and sisters. We have had some on cousins.
But at this point, the Red Cross cannot handle the DWIs. In terms of disaster relief, the DWIs have rather a low priority as opposed to medical needs, shelter needs, feeding needs. So it takes them a little longer to get the disaster welfare inquiry cadre in place. They usually physically have to go around to get the different pieces of information from the hospitals, from the police and the various people concerning casualties, and all this takes time. They're telling us that they don't have that information. It's not in place yet. As soon as it's in place and they're ready to respond, they'll send us a message and say that they're accepting disaster welfare inquiries.
There will be a congressional probe next month of how the Army Corps of Engineers came to change its mind about the proposed Nyakach Causeway. Representative George Miller of California wants to know why District Engineer Colonel William Kuechel initially denied a permit for the BP project and then reversed himself and reopened the proceeding. It's no secret that BP pressed Kuechel's superiors hard for the reversal, but Corps officials maintain they judge the situation on its own merits. Miller says he questions whether officials in Washington know enough about causeways in the Alaska Beaufort Sea to be making such decisions, and he scheduled hearings to look into the matter. Steve Heimel reports.
There is supposed to be no way to appeal a district engineer's decision. So when Colonel Kuechel decided against the causeway, the only route available to BP was to either accept the decision or try to get him to change his mind. The probe will center on the tactics used to bring about that change. Causeways offer the industry road access to drilling sites and a pipeline location for delivering the oil, and that saves money. But biologists and oceanographers are nervous about them because they change the water circulation pattern, though nobody's sure what the impacts are on the fish population. The first causeway, ARCO's West Dock, sort of grew on its own with little regulation. The second, BP's Endicott, obtained its permit with difficulty, and at that time the Corps said it would be the last. Then ARCO wanted to build one halfway across the mouth of Prudhoe Bay for the Lisburn project. By 1988, ARCO had changed its mind and said it would accomplish its purpose with directional drilling from shore. But ARCO still went ahead with completing an environmental assessment for the project that ends up saying that the fish impact is temporary and depends on the weather. Millions and perhaps billions of dollars are riding on the causeway issue. BP says the geology at Nyakach is such that directional drilling would be risky, and the field's economics are marginal, even with the causeway. Interior Department officials are known to be very concerned that the causeway option not be closed because they may be needed to the east, off the shore of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Corps of Engineers is stuck in the middle. When he reopened the proceeding on Nyakach last February, Colonel Kuechel provided the news media with a three-page fact sheet that said the early decision had been an error because it hadn't let the state comment on water quality issues. It said an internal review process had identified those flaws. That process involved the colonel's superiors at division headquarters in Portland and General Patrick Kelly in Washington, the Corps Director of Civil Works. Kelly told his superiors that from now on Kuechel would have to run any causeway decision through Portland. The Corps also asked its own lab to do a new causeway study, and that document is sitting in Portland. Nyakuk is not the only pending causeway issue. The Corps has also not yet decided whether to order BP to put more openings in its Endicott causeway. There's no indication yet of when these decisions will come out. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Many of Alaska's rural school districts, which are overwhelmingly made up of Native students, are showing decidedly mixed results in their efforts to hire more Native teachers. Mike Lane reports that districts that wait for Natives to come to them are finding few, if any, applicants, while those that make an aggressive effort to recruit Native teachers are finding success.
Most rural school districts have, in one way or another, committed themselves to the goal of hiring more Natives to fill vacancies at the professional level. Teachers, administrators, program directors. And a comparison of the three rural education attendance areas along the Kuskokwim River shows how, in some cases, the effort is paying off, and in others, how hard finding certified Native educators is. The Kuskbuck School District, covering the mid-river villages from Kalskag to Stony River, has but one of 54 certified positions filled by a Native. According to Antioch High School principal Bobette Bush, the low total in the district is not caused by a lack of trying. Bush says that in her 3 years of hiring, she hasn't had one Native applicant. And she noted that the teacher turnover rate is now very low, offering few chances to hire someone new. Upriver in the Iditarod Area School District, 24% or 11 of the 45 certified positions are held by Natives. Joyce Shales, Iditarod's instructional administrator, herself a Tlingit, says the reason for the district's good Native hire record is their dedicated effort.
The way we've gone about looking for Native Alaskans is on campus in Fairbanks during the summer. I'm going to attend Chief's job fair in Fairbanks, calling people at Tanana Chief's at the University of Alaska, teacher placement, not the placement office, because they haven't been that much help, but the student-teacher coordinator in Fairbanks, who knows all the student-teachers who have been out and all over the place and recommends people to us from time to time. We find them mostly by word of mouth and by putting out the word that we are interested in Native Americans or minorities in the Iditarod School District.
The Lower Kuskokwim School District, the largest of the three Kuskokwim River REAAs, has 232 certified teaching positions, 11% of which are held by Natives. In real numbers, that's 26 teachers. Steve Ronnekamp, the district's personnel officer, says they're always on the lookout for qualified Natives to fill certified vacancies, and in fact, they're working to make it happen by paying three area Natives to attend college. The three were chosen from among district classroom employees who'd completed 60 hours of semester work towards a degree. It's a slow, costly way to swell the ranks of Natives at the head of the class, but after 14 years and billions of dollars of state money setting up a state-run public education system in the bush, it could be the best educational investment yet. In McGrath, I'm Mike Lane.
We sent to Soviet Armenia some specialized rescue teams, including the search and rescue dogs from the Juneau area. We were able to help there. We've got a C-130 going to Travis Air Force Base in California on Thursday from Alaska, and if we can offer some emergency gear to the Bay Area people, we're happy to do that.
Well, I would say that we're probably as ready as we could be within the limited resources that we have available to draw on, but the California plans that they have implemented, we have utilized as models for our own plans for implementation.
Is there anything that you've noticed in the immediate aftermath?
Not really. Certainly, we don't have the multi-story construction and the two-story freeways, which have appear to contribute to the number of casualties and fatalities that they have. So a 6.9 earthquake up here due to the dispersal of the population, I don't think that we would sustain as great a damage as they have experienced down in San Francisco and the surrounding area. It would depend upon the exact location of the epicenter, but we could sustain major damage and major casualties with something higher than a 7.5 earthquake. We could have real problems.
3, 2, 1. Back in a quiet corner of the UAF campus, next to married student housing and where children are playing, three houses make up the Nana dorm. Freshman boys live in one house, girls another, and house parents Greg and Nellie Moore live in the third with their two elementary school-aged children. The Nana Regional Corporation began paying for the Nana dorm program 6 years ago. The Moores have lived here for the past 2 years. Nellie Moore is a Kotzebue native who attended college at UAF in the mid-70s. She knows how tough it can be for these kids as she now helps them adjust to campus life.
Some of the problems range from bringing students in from rural areas who come from very small high schools and do not get an education adequate for entry-level courses at the university campus. We also face a problem of trying to help students deal with professors who would just as soon weed them out rather than deal with them. That's a big problem for us. And trying to help them cope with living in a much larger community where, you know, things are a lot faster and different, and they don't have that, you know, core village atmosphere of having a large number of people who care a lot about them.
They need a ride to Safeway or 7-Eleven. I charge them those 75 cents a trip.
75 cents, don't believe that.
Verne Seam and Lance Kramer are two of the students living in the Nana houses this fall. They're part of a group that Nellie Moore thinks will do well.
From what I've seen, they're more independent than students we've had in the past, and I think are enjoying being here.
So far this year, both Lance and Bernay say things are going well. Both students are pretty typical freshmen, enjoying the less structured course schedule than in high school, and even trying to catch a soap opera when they can in the afternoon. A hunter and fisherman from Kotzebue, Lance is planning to get into wildlife management and wants to go back to Kotzebue and work for the Department of Fish and Game when his studies are finished.
It's really comfortable in there, you know. It's not like a dorm at McIntosh or any place, because, you know, it's either noisy there or people are partying all the time. But this is a nice, it's like living at home, except you got five brothers.
Verne is one of three girls in the dorm this year. Verne has lived in Kiana for the last 2 years. She came to UAF for the Rural Alaska Honors Institute the past two summers and says that prepared her well for college life. She's a very active freshman and wanted to live in the Nana house so that she could become a little more disciplined.
I like the structure. The summer programs that I went to at Rawhide were very structured and very intense. And I like the idea of having something that'll help me be responsible and help me get those skills down so I can have them later on.
The fact that Verne and Lance believe they are doing okay in school this fall should come as some relief to Nellie Moore. Moore feels the difference between attending small native high schools and other high schools in the state can be too much for some students.
It's a real tragedy, I think, what we're doing to some of the students, because they come here from high schools like that thinking, you know, that they've received a good education and probably have graduated with honors from their high schools, and they come here and they can't handle it. You know, the courses are too hard, or, you know, they can't make it into the 100 level courses, so they spend a couple of years in the, you know, the 050s and courses like that. So I think it's a real, they come here and they end up having a real identity crisis.
Right now, the Nana dorm is only for freshmen, but things could change. As students enter higher grade levels, they face even more demanding course schedules. Moore says they still have a lot of difficulty and need the support the Nana dorm can bring. For National Native News in Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. Three, two, one. Back in a quiet corner of the UAF campus, next to married student housing and where children are playing, three houses make up the Nana dorm. Freshman boys live in one house, girls another, and house parents Greg and Nellie Moore live in the third with their two elementary school-age children. The Nana Regional Corporation began paying for the Nana dorm program 6 years ago. The Moores have lived here for the past 2 years. Nellie Moore is a Kotzebue native who attended college at UAF in the mid-70s. She knows how tough it can be for these kids, as she now helps them adjust to campus life. Verne Seam and Lance Kramer are two of the students living in the Nana houses this fall. They are part of a group that Nellie Moore thinks will do well. So far this year, both Lance and Verne say things are going well. Both students are pretty typical freshmen, enjoying the less structured course schedule than in high school, and even trying to catch a soap opera when they can in the afternoon. A hunter and fisherman from Kotzebue, Lance is planning to get into wildlife management and wants to go back to Kotzebue and work for the Department of Fish and Game when his studies are finished. Verne is one of three girls in the dorm this year. Verne has lived in Kiana for the last 2 years. She came to UAF for the Rural Alaska Honors Institute the past two summers and says that prepared her well for college life. She's a very active freshman and wanted to live in the Nana house so that she could become a little more disciplined. The fact that Verne and Lance believe they are doing okay in school this fall should come as some relief to Nellie Moore. Moore feels the difference between attending small native high schools and other high schools in the state can be too much for some students. Right now, the Nana dorm is only for freshmen, but things could change. As students enter higher grade levels, they face even more demanding course schedules. Moore says they still have a lot of difficulty and need the support the Nana dorm can bring. For National Native News in Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.